The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The Federal Reserve is, in fact, raising interest rates by 0.75 percentage point. The fourth rate hike so far this year.
There's a new economic report is out, and it shows the U.S. could be in a recession. The Commerce Department's report shows America's gross domestic product went down 0.9% from April to June. This is the second consecutive quarter the GDP was negative. Historically, that does mean the country is in recession. But the White House disagrees, saying there are other areas of the economy that are still growing.
I think, John, is that we have triggered the technical definition of recession, but the analytical definition, which most economists embrace, suggests that we are not yet in a recession, but the risk is high. The two key questions that we're going to be talking a lot about in the next few months is, if we end up in a recession, how shallow or how deep is that recession? And secondly, how sticky is inflation on its way down? And I'm yet to hear any compelling argument that says we know where we're going in terms of growth and we know where we're going in terms of inflation. I think there's a lot of uncertainty ahead.
This week, Russia's state energy supplier Gazprom slashed gas supply yet again to Germany through the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. Germany's network operator says flows have now sunk to just 20% of normal levels. That means it'll be difficult for the country to fill its reserve before the weather gets cold in Germany. And any further reductions could trigger emergency gas rationing.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
GDP contracted for the second consecutive quarter as the U.S. economy officially enters a recession. Economic fundamentals continue to deteriorate, pointing to further economic weakness ahead as the Fed continues its aggressive rate hikes, raising the Fed funds rate by 75 basis points to the 2.25 and 2.5 range. Chairman Powell indicated the Fed would continue to raise interest rates at its next meeting in September. Meanwhile, inflation continues unabated as the Fed's preferred inflation gauge moved higher last month to its highest level in over four decades. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck is Tom McClellan. Tom sees the present rally in stocks failing as we head into the month of August, with a decline well into the month of November. Tom's favorite sector is agriculture, as the globe faces possible food shortages this fall. Later on, Rick Sharga from Adam Data joins me as we look at today's real estate market. The Fed rate hikes are definitely impacting the real estate market, but despite rising interest rates, the demand for real estate remains solid as the millennials, the largest segment of the population, entered their prime home buying years. The nation still does not have enough homes to meet demand, as home builders went on a building hiatus for over a decade following the financial crisis. Finally, Chris Poplava will be here with another edition of Smart Macro. Before we do that, let's find out the stories moving this week's markets with Ryan Poplava.
This week, stocks tacked on another strong week of gains to finish the month, reversing some of the deep losses experienced year to date. In fact, the S&P 500 is up 9.1% to finish July, while the Nasdaq Composite is up 12.3%. What warranted the rally this month and additionally this week? Some may ask, short covering, and a bid to add back exposure to stocks as a result of some of the highest levels of cash portfolios have seen since April of 2020, according to survey data from Bank of America. There was a lot to cover in the news this week, but the biggest event was the Federal Reserve policy decision and the statement along with the following conference call with Chairman Powell. The Fed raised the Fed funds rate another 75 basis points to 2.25 to 2.5% range, as expected. The market's response to this was largely muted due to the expectations being met. It was comments from Powell that set bulls in motion. It was hard to track the exact moment trying to listen in and follow along with the stock rebound, but I think it was Powell's comments about slowing the pace of rate increases that really set stocks on fire.
As the stance of monetary policy tightens further, it likely will become appropriate to slow the pace of increases while we assess how our cumulative policy adjustments are affecting the economy and inflation.
Powell later said the Fed wouldn't give clear guidance. Each meeting from here, rate policy will be determined by the data. The last time I checked the Fed funds futures, predictions are for 2 rate cuts in the first half of 2023. Powell didn't say anything to support these views, but it is the views of investors that weakening economic news will lead to this conclusion. This week, the yield curve inversion deepened. The 2-year note fell 9 basis points to 2.9%, while the 10-year yield fell 14 basis points to 2.64%, well below that 2.9% 2-year note, which has been often cited as a harbinger of a recession, leading by about 6 months to 18 months, according to research. Let's talk about the economic results this week. Released this week, the PCE price index hit 6.8%, which is the highest year-over-year reading since 1982, talking about inflation. The consumer confidence index fell its 3rd month in a row, and new home sales dropped from a rate of 696,000 sales a year to about 590,000, seasonally adjusted. The advanced reading on the second quarter GDP came in with its 2nd negative reading in a row at negative 0.9%. So there has been a lot of discussion this week whether that constitutes a recession and whether there are other tools to determine if one has begun or not. So I won't debate that at this time. The one upside this week was the surprise increase in the durable goods orders for June, despite some of the regional manufacturing data souring as of late. Ryan Sweet of Moody's said the absence of a sustained decline in orders suggests that businesses are still investing despite tighter financial market conditions, a drop in sentiment, and worries about recession. My guess is because supply chains are still tight. But overall, I think the bearish news on the economy helped lend itself to the drop in long-term yields and a deeper curve inversion. Now, talking about earnings, there were about 175 S&P 500 companies reporting this week, so very, very busy week. Despite warnings from Walmart that stated food and fuel are hurting general merchandise categories, there was a warning from Best Buy about soft consumer electronic demand, and a warning from Stanley Black & Decker about consumer demand, investors largely shrugged off the comments and disregarded the economic news, painting a similar picture. Instead, investors jumped on tech and growth stocks, consumer discretionary, etc., and energy stocks especially, on some news from Congress passing a $280 billion bill, including about $52 billion, which is going to be earmarked for semiconductor manufacturing capacity to help fight back against competition from China. On the plus side on earnings, Alphabet, Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon have either better than feared results or better guidance that encourage investment in these areas. Energy had a very strong week, up 10.3%, helped by strong earnings gains from Chevron and ExxonMobil. And despite the issues and concerns over the consumer discretionary sector closed up almost 19% for the month, with Tesla up 32% and Amazon up 27% for the month. Because of the rally this month, year-to-date losses have been cut substantially. Year-to-date, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 9.6%, the S&P 500 is down 13.3%, the Russell 2000 Small Cap Index is down 16%, and the NASDAQ is down 20.8%. That wraps up this week's key catalyst, which was mainly the Fed, and the response that maybe the Fed plans to slow the pace of rate increases in the near future, but not essentially removing the idea that we could still see another 75 basis point hike in September if inflation is still hot. Up next, Tom McClelland to give us his technical views on the financial markets.
In the last 2.5 years, all the governments around the world have printed maybe some $30 trillion in new money that they've injected into the markets. They were also saying at the same time, oh, it's not going to incur negative impact on inflation. Then they came out with the statement, it's transitory. And we just felt that this can't be transitory. So that's why we just really felt, how do we get to an accurate number? And how do we take a developer mindset in going and acquiring those numbers, processing those numbers, and making sure that they're available in a scalable format? What would that look like? And that's sort of what we went about doing, and that resulted in trueflation.com, where we monitor 10 million items, because we have today not 477 government workers. We have available the whole Google Cloud services and DigitalOcean data centers as our resources and compute resources to manage the aggregation of pricing information across 10 million items.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the U.S. economy enters into a recession as GDP contracts two quarters in a row with slowing economic indicators. The Fed raises interest rates for the fourth time this year by 75 basis points. Well, if there's any good news in all of this, stocks have been in a rally mode this week, but let's find out where this ends. Joining us on the program is Tom McClellan. And Tom, you sent me a couple charts, and why don't we begin with those, and we're going to make these available to our listeners. One is the University of Michigan Consumer Index. What's this chart telling you?
What it shows, we're comparing the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index to the U.S. unemployment rate. And the point is that the two are very well correlated, but with about a 10-month lag. So whatever happens in consumer sentiment will happen about 10 months later to the unemployment rate. And so as we are all getting into class on what is the definition of a recession this week, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research, it's not actually two quarters of successive GDP shrinkage, although that was proposed back in 1974 in a New York Times column. It's never been officially adopted. The NBER says that a recession is whatever they decide it is, and they will have appointed themselves as the sole determinants of whether there's a recession. So we'll find out 6 months from now that we have been in a recession. But the people who are looking at the unemployment rate and saying, well, unemployment's at 3.6%. We can't possibly be in a recession with the unemployment rate still doing fine. Those people don't understand that the unemployment rate lags quite a bit, lags lots of things. It's among the last things to turn in an economic turn. And we are going to see a big turn in the unemployment rate based on what the consumer sentiment index data say. We've seen a big drop in sentiment, which in the chart shows as a surge because I've inverted the scaling. So it's a surge in pessimism and over to the to a new all-time record in terms of the University of Michigan data. And that means that we have a big rise in unemployment to do over at least the next 10 months.
Well, you know, we're seeing anecdotal information. You're seeing some of the tech companies that are going on hiring freezes, reneging on job offers, and you're just starting to see the first signs of layoffs that are coming from companies. Companies are talking about squeezed margins because of input cost and labor cost, and so it's beginning. So what this tells us is where we may be a year from now.
Yeah, and the weekly jobless claims have been rising slowly and steadily. They should start to pick up a little bit more momentum as we go into the next few weeks. But they are going to tell you ahead of the unemployment rate that there's pressure in the jobs market, and they've been telling us that message.
Okay, now the second chart that you are showing is the New York Stock Exchange adjusted advanced decline line. Explain what this is saying about what's happening in the stock market and how does it relate?
Well, it's another comparison of something to the jobs market. In this case, I'm using the advanced decline line or the AD line. And it is a measure of the behavior of all the stocks on the stock exchange. Every day on the stock exchange, there are some number of stocks that go up and some number that go down. The difference between those is the advanced decline difference, or the daily breadth. And if you sum that over time, you get what's known as the advanced decline line. Ratio adjusted means I'm just adjusting it for the changing number of issues that are trade. And that way we can make better long-term comparisons. In this second chart that you're referring to, I'm showing the advanced decline line versus the JOLTS data, the job openings and labor turnover survey data. And that's basically a reflection of how many jobs there openings that there are. That data peaked back in March of 2022. The advanced decline line peaked back in October. And so we had an initial indication from the advanced decline line that there was trouble. And sure enough, we're seeing that in the JOLTS data with 2 months down movement. And we get the next JOLTS number August 2nd. So I'm expecting another downward move. And the JOLTS data will usually turn before the unemployment rate data will turn. And the advanced decline line will turn before the JOLTS data will turn. So we've had a warning from the stock market that there's going to be trouble for the jobs market. We're starting to see that now. We're going to see it more and more over the next few months.
You know, when the economy starts to slow down, we've seen negative numbers in the GDP numbers. And I believe strongly the third quarter is going to be negative as well, based on the macroeconomic numbers I'm seeing. But this time around, consumers are dealing with something, Tom, we haven't had to deal with for almost four decades. They're seeing gas prices at record levels. They're seeing food prices are just skyrocketing. Everything's up almost, that I look at double digits. One of my favorite fast food places that I go to, I am now paying the same price for one meal that I used to pay for two meals going back to January.
And it's really coming down to energy being the biggest driver of that. Even though gasoline is only 4% of the CPI calculation, gasoline factors into everything else that you buy that's a product. And it also factors into the affordability of any services that you buy in terms of somebody who's going to provide that service to you and they've got to drive to get to work. So when all the costs of moving people and stuff around start to go up, then that cost gets to get padded into the prices that we pay for everything. And lots of presidents, including the current one, really don't seem to understand that to their detriment. If you have rising energy prices, it tends to correlate really, really well with falling approval ratings for presidents. Past presidents have figured that out, but the current one hasn't figured that out yet. And if you could ever do anything to want to get reelected as a president, you'd do everything you could to make sure that there were low energy prices. But that's not the policy we have now. And so, yeah, it's making it really hard. We're having this inflation that is being stubborn and is not coming down. And we're seeing high inflation and the Fed fighting that high inflation right as we're heading into a recession. It's going to be a difficult time.
Yeah, because what makes this a little unusual from my perspective, I'd like to get your historical thoughts on this. Normally, when we see the Fed go through a rate raising cycle, they're doing it because the economy is overheating. You know, I think back of where we were in 2007. We had inflation. The economy was strong. This time, the Fed is tightening as the economy's weakening. I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Yes, that's correct. They are doing that, and they think that it will help, and they're wrong, because there's not much that the Fed has in terms of arrows in its particular quiver that can help. If you want to wave a magic wand, get energy prices down, and then wait about a year, and all the rest of the data will start to follow from that. Unemployment rate, which I mentioned before, that tends to follow the inflation rate with a lag time of about 2 years. So if you want to arrange to have a healthy condition for jobs and unemployment, just arrange to have low inflation and then wait 2 years. And so the upturn that we're going to be starting to see in the unemployment rate starting imminently is just a reflection of the upturn that we saw starting 2 years ago in the inflation rate. And the Fed has not gotten a handle on it. The federal government and Congress have fueled it even more by giving student loan forgiveness, or not really forgiveness, deferral on student loan payments. So that keeps money in people's pockets. And they handed out PPP loans to businesses, and they handed out free COVID money to people. And sure enough, people went and spent that money, driving up the prices of the available goods and services that there were. So it's not something that the Fed really has the tools to fix. All that money sloshing around isn't going to go anywhere, and we're going to have to just get used to new price levels that fit the amount of money that the federal government and the Fed have stuffed into the economy.
The irony is they still don't get the message, because they're about ready to pass a new $2 trillion spending program they're calling the anti-inflation bill, which is a joke, because it's going to be inflationary. But, you know, at the time the Fed is fighting inflation, we got the physical side of government, which is pumping and pumping trillions of dollars into the economy. I just don't see how this works out.
Well, it works out not very well. It works out with higher prices for everything. It works out with higher unemployment, which is going to lag those higher prices by about 2 years. If you could get inflation down to 0% tomorrow, if somehow you could do that, we would still see a rise in the unemployment rate, because the unemployment rate lags inflation by about 2 years. So you have to fix inflation first, and then the unemployment rate will follow. It probably won't follow fast enough to help the prospects of anyone who's a current political office holder. But that's what, if you want to fix the economy, those are the levers that you have to pull, and then you have to wait. And that is the frustrating thing. People generally are not very good at waiting. They want immediate response to action, and that's just not how the economy works.
And so let's go to your final chart, which is zinc prices. And let me see, you have aluminum and zinc and cash. Now, what is that telling us about where the direction of commodities is heading?
Well, it's three different metals prices: zinc, aluminum, and lead, all of which are industrial metals. You don't have an aluminum ring on your finger, but these are very industrial metals. And I'm comparing that to the CPI rate of change. And the message here is actually a good one, that we've seen a big reduction in metals prices and in the industrial metals prices. Copper has also come down, but copper's pricing doesn't allow it to fit as nicely on this chart. All three of these metals are priced at about the same dollar price, and so you can fit them nicely on the same scaling. And the point is that the peaks in these industrial metals prices tend to precede peaks in the inflation rate by several months. And we've had a nice peak earlier this year in all of the metals prices, and they're coming down dramatically. So we can figure that we're going to see a drop in the inflation rate as 2022 starts to come to a close. We've probably seen the high posting for the CPI inflation rate with the current number, and it should start coming down this year. And that'll eventually mean good news for unemployment after the two-year lag, but there is some good news from the drop in metals prices.
All right. Well, let's turn this around. And what does this mean for investors? This week, we're doing this interview on a Thursday, and the markets have been up all week. What do you see ahead?
Well, the movement up from the July low is something that I would have been expecting. My leading indicator that I did not bring to show you is telling us to expect a failing rally into the early part of August. It'll not seem like a failing rally. It'll seem like we're starting a new bull market. The bottom's behind us. Never mind about the economy. It's all going to be fine. That's what failing rallies tend to do, is they do the job on sentiment that they need to do to get everybody leaning too far one way. And then the chair falls away again and you fall some more. We're going to continue falling into November for the stock market. Not in a straight line, not straight down like 1987, but in a long, grinding, bumping down, illiquid situation where the good news just doesn't seem to help and the bad news is persistent and it's going to last for a while. I don't see the end of this yet. It could possibly end in November, but we need to get some more data in to tell me what's ahead for 2023, and I just don't have that data yet. But we're still in a bear market. This is just a counter trend rally. It's a fun one. I enjoyed catching it in the QQQ, and I got out of that today. Personally, what you do is up to you, but it's been a fun rally. I'm not ready to play it on the short side again yet, because when you're making higher highs and higher lows, you don't want to be too aggressive on the short side. But when I see signs of a downturn appearing in price oscillators and advanced decline oscillators, then I'll be getting positioned to ride the red down wave with a short bet. Today's not that day yet, but it'll be coming. And it's still going to be a long downtrend, so cash is not a bad place to be if you're a long-term investor. One day we will eventually get to where it's going to pay to be a buy and hold person again. Today is not that day.
Tom, what about some of these rallies that have made it really sort of difficult to short? If you take a look at where the market was in April, we came down, we had a little bit of sideways action, went down further, we rallied, came down, now we're rallying again.
It's a characteristic of a bear market that the counter trend rallies are really exciting and they're really rapid and they get everybody pulled in and say, oh, finally, the bottom's in and we're going up. That's what the counter trend rallies need to do is get everybody leaning too far that way. We saw several examples of those all the way down during the 2008 bear market. There were some really wonderful counter trend rallies that year, but you didn't want to stay too long. And that there's an important lesson here. When you see a rally like we're seeing right now in late July, it can be just a counter trend rally. It can also be the start of a new bull market. And that's the difficulty is how do you make the distinction between which one of those it is? And there are several ways that we talk about in our newsletter, the McClellan Market Report, to look at the breadth statistics for confirmation that you have a lot of oomph behind the push. When you see a rally that looks like it should be initiating a new bull market and it fails, that's a sign you're still in a bear market. When you see rallies that reveal themselves to just be counter trend rallies, that's a tell that you're still in a bear market, and which I think we still are, and we have more work to do to the downside.
You know, it's. I want to talk about interest rates because this may seem counterintuitive for many people because the Fed is raising interest rates as they did this week by 75 basis points, and yet long-term bond yields are coming down, signaling we're more likely heading into a recession. So what's your take on interest rates here? How much further do we go lower? Where do you see rates going here during the same period by November? So if we were going
it is an excellent quandary that with inflation at 9%, who would want to loan their money to the federal government for 30 years at 3%? That's a ridiculous idea. But that's the bond market that we have. And for 10 years, it's 2.7% about right now. That's not a very good way to manage your money, but our long-term models for what long-term yields are going to do say yields should be coming down this year and toward the end of 2022, probably bottoming around November. And we'll look. And I say that based on the observation that long-term interest rates, and I'm talking about the 30-year Treasury bond, they tend to follow the movements of gold prices with a lag time of about 20 and a half months. So whatever gold prices are doing now, and they're going up today, whatever gold prices are doing now, you'll see the same behavior in long-term interest rates 20 and a half months later. It's a fascinating phenomenon, and I cannot explain why it works exactly like that, nor can I explain why it's 20 and a half months, but that's what history shows us, and we have got a long track record to show that it does work with that lag time for the most part, except when you have a COVID crash, for example. But the message from gold from 20 and a half months ago is that gold was declining then, and so interest rates should be declining until about November and should swoop back up again into early 2023. So when I was on with you several months ago, I banged the table about you need to get your mortgage refinanced. And I hope people did before the big run-up that we've just seen. If you missed the boat, there'll be another opportunity around November, but it won't be very much good next year.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. So, Tom, you know, we saw the difficulty in trying to short, so we went long treasuries figuring the economy was weakening, and that's panned out. Coming out of this, let's say the market bottoms in November, turns around, and we begin a new rally. Where would you position yourself? In other words, what sectors do you think look promising based on the charts?
Oil is not good for the rest of this year because oil also tends to follow the movements of gold prices with a lag time just a little bit shorter than bonds. It's about 19 and a half months for oil prices. And so that should mean that we see oil prices continuing to come down until about late October of this year. Oil prices could be good in the early part of 2023, but not for very long, because as we know, recently, gold has dropped from 2000 down to 1700. And so oil will be echoing that drop several months from now. So I'm not as excited about oil in the early 2023 period as I am about other opportunities. Gold actually looks pretty good, but not for very long because it's still in a long-term downtrend lasting until about 2025. At which point it'll begin a new three-year up phase from its low in the early 2025 is when that cycle low is due. So gold is not a great opportunity. Cash is pretty nice if you can earn anything on it. agriculture is looking pretty good because people are not going to stop eating. And Bill Gates is making that bet by buying up, I think he's up to 200,000 acres of Midwest corn growing land because people are going to keep eating. Being the marginal consumer of food is not very popular. Generally speaking, 2023 is the third year of a presidential term, and those are nearly always up years for the overall market. And I'm talking about the S&P 500. Only conditions like you had in 1939 when Hitler was marching through Poland, or 1931 when we were in the Great Depression. When you have conditions like that, you can have a down year in the third year of a presidential term, but most of the time it's an up year. So we should have a weak up year in 2023. I look for a really awful bear market for the stock market in the second half of 2024. So whoever's going to be running on the Democratic ticket for president will have no chance of winning election in 2024, regardless of who it is, just because bear markets are bad for whoever the incumbent party candidate is that's running for president.
We've seen it with George W. or even his father. His father began his second term or ran in his second term in a recession. He lost. And George W. did get elected his second term. But at the end of the term, we were in a recession. Exactly. And they lost. So it's the way things work.
In 2008, Bush 43 was not running for re-election, but the incumbent party candidate was McCain, and he got trounced because the stock market was going down, and bear markets are not good for whoever is the incumbent party candidate. And so that's I'm expecting that similar sort of outcome in 2024 with a big bear market, especially in the end of that year, based on really long-term cycle work, and not a good time to be an investor. When we get to the bottom of that really ugly bear market in 2025 or 26, that'll be a good time to be a buy and hold investor again. But it's going to be a long time sitting and patiently waiting for that opportunity.
Well, listen, Tom, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them about your website and the things they'll find there.
If you Google Tom McClellan, you'll find us. Our website is mcoscillator.com. That's a contraction of McClellan Oscillator, the indicator that my parents developed back in 1969 that tracks the acceleration in the advanced decline data, and which a lot of technicians use. I use it. I think it's pretty good, but I'm biased. MCOscillator.com. We have a twice monthly newsletter. We have a daily edition that comes out every day the market trades. We even have a free weekly chart and focus series. You can sign up for free, no strings attached. The good stuff is in the newsletter and the daily edition, but you can find out about the indicators that we use in our Chart and Focus series.
All right. Well, listen, Tom, thanks so much for coming on the program. Have a great rest of the summer. We'll talk to you again in the fall.
20% of Americans said that the political stability of the country is extremely threatened by the political division of Americans, with another 26% says very threatened. So you're talking about 45% of Americans think the political stability in the United States is either very or extremely threatened by the polarization in the country right now. You think, oh, wow, Russia is a much bigger problem for the U.S. Okay, well, China for that matter. But right now, the biggest threat to American democracy is not authoritarianism, but rather polarization within the U.S.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939. or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says contact us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on the program is Rick Sharger from Adam Data Solutions. And Rick, we're doing this interview on a Tuesday. It's widely expected they'll raise the Fed funds rate by 0.75 points, so that'll take it up to 2.25 to 2.5, probably one of the most rapid rate increases we've seen in more than several decades. So what impact is this having on the real estate market?
Well, Jim, thanks for inviting me to be with you today. I always enjoy our conversations. If the Fed had set out to slow down an overheated housing market, with Fed fund rates rising, they've done a remarkably efficient job. And I think probably a very purposeful job, as housing costs are a significant part of consumer inflation. So I think the next basis point raise, whether it's 0.75 point or a full point, as some people are speculating, is aimed at continuing to cool off that white hot housing market, but also to try and get under control some of the other components of inflation that the Fed simply hasn't been able to get its arms around yet.
You know, let's talk about one component of that inflation, which is rents. I mean, people here in Southern California, where I live, Rick, are really struggling. I mean, the rents have just been going up by double digits. It looks like it's continuing.
It's a fallacy that rents go down as home prices go up, or vice versa. What we've seen over the last couple of years, Jim, is a wholesale increase in both home prices and rental rates. And in fact, nationally, the asking rent for new tenants has been about 14% higher on a year-over-year basis. And that's just unprecedented. That's a number that historically is somewhere between 1% and 4%. So it's off the charts in terms of the increase. And it's due largely to historically low vacancy rates. What I believe will ultimately be proven to be miscalculations on the part of the Census Bureau is the rate of household formation over the last few years. And to be fair, hard to count household growth while everybody's, you know, sequestered due to a global pandemic. But we have the largest group of young adults aged 25 to 33 in history forming households. There's very little for them to buy. They do tend to prefer to live indoors, and so they're looking for something to rent. And candidly, rental inventory simply hasn't kept pace with the demand. So yeah, rent rates have gone through the roof. It's a little better if you're a current renter, because your landlord's not generally disposed to raising your rent 15% if you're already in place. But for people looking to rent for the first time or looking to move into a new apartment, the prices are just outrageous.
Yeah, I'm hearing anecdotal stories from my clients about their kids who are millennials. They're renting and having to move because it's gotten so expensive in the rental market that they have to move further and further away from where they work to places like outside the city or the suburbs where the rents are a bit cheaper.
So you just tapped into one of the trends that we're following, and it's a very real trend. In the mortgage industry, there's something called drive to qualify. And basically that means you drive further and further out from city center until you find a property that's inexpensive enough for you to afford a mortgage. The pandemic sort of accelerated that a bit as people started looking for larger houses that they could maybe have a home office in or do homeschooling in if they needed to. But we're also seeing a huge flight out of metropolitan areas like New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, not just into suburban areas or secondary markets, but into other states. So if you look at states like Idaho, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, Texas, they're getting a lot of transplants from the state of California. I recently visited my son, who's working in South Dakota right now. And my Lyft and Uber drivers were bemoaning the fact that prices were going up because of all the Californians moving into the state and paying cash for homes. So we are seeing that. The good news, I guess, for millennials and for others is that due to the pandemic, there are a lot more opportunities for people to work from home. So they really can work from almost anywhere. And given that, they tend to be looking into markets that are more affordable, lower cost, lower tax states, where they can get more house for their money and live comfortably.
Yeah, one of my clients is a custom home builder here in San Diego, and he's telling me, as a result of the pandemic, where what couldn't you do? You couldn't go to a gym. You couldn't go to a movie theater. You were working from home. So a lot of the homes that they're building, they're putting in gyms, movie yep. theaters, and home offices. Is that a trend that you see not just here in, let's say, California, but around the country?
Oh, absolutely. And again, as you get into somewhat less expensive markets, it's a little easier for people to afford that larger house with that home office, with that home gym. Haven't heard as much about home theaters, but I guess that makes sense as well. But yeah, absolutely, that's a trend. And by the way, it broke a tendency that we've been seeing really coming out of the Great Recession, which is people were looking for smaller homes. Or if they were looking at larger homes, they wanted that extra bedroom. And now that extra bedroom is no longer on the wish list. It's a home office. So yeah, fundamental change that came out of the pandemic. And, you know, you're talking about being in Southern California, where I also live. Last year was the first year in decades where the state showed a net loss of population on a year-over-year basis. I believe about 300,000 more people left the state than moved to the state. And that again, broke a decades-long trend. But we believe it's an indication of a trend that's not going to go away anytime soon, that new work from home opportunity is going to drive people into more affordable states where they can have a very high quality of life and not be paying through the nose for it.
You know, it's amazing, Rick. You know, we hear about Californians moving to Nevada, Arizona, Texas, even Florida, even Idaho. And the thing is, I had a client that was looking at homes in Phoenix, and I guess Phoenix was the number one city in the country last year for property price appreciation of 33%. He was absolutely blown away. He said, I never thought I would go someplace where it was more expensive than San Diego.
Well, then he probably wants to stay away from Boise. Actually outranked Phoenix last year. Home prices went up there about 45%.
And oh, my God.
I promise you there is nothing endemic to the local Boise economy that drove prices that high. It was out-of-staters coming in. St. George's, Utah, and Phoenix. Those were the top three last year. And you know, it depends on what you look for. If you're looking at a similar house for house, you're still going to probably pay more in San Diego or Orange County or Los Angeles County than you will in Maricopa County in Phoenix. But the prices did go up. There was a lot of investor activity in Phoenix last year. A lot of investors going in and buying houses to either fix and flip. iBuyers were very, very dominant in Phoenix last year with their sort of arbitrage model. And then you had a lot of buyers going in and buying houses that they converted to rental units because of that rental demand we talked about. So yeah, I mean, Phoenix, this past year has been a hot market, and not just because of the temperatures.
So when you look at this and you look at where the Fed's going on raising rates, obviously they're trying to cool the economy, which they're doing a good job. I'm looking at a Bloomberg screen of inventory levels going up and also new home sales falling. So their policies are doing what they want them to do. At what point do you think they settle down? In other words, well, we'll see anything like we did coming out of the financial crisis, where at least in the first time in my lifetime, Rick, we saw home prices drop by 30-40%.
So I'm glad you mentioned that was the first time you'd seen it, because as I run around the country talking at different events and talking to different groups, I tell everybody to settle down. We're not looking at 2008 all over again. And somebody inevitably says to me, you don't know what you're talking about. This happens all the time. Prices go way up and then they crash. And so I actually did some research, which proves that I need a life desperately, but tracked 100 years of U.S. home prices. And we've had a drop of more than 20% for a measurable period exactly once in that 100-year period. And that was during the Great Recession. And it was a time when housing got completely out of control because of bad lending practices. People in houses that really couldn't afford them never should have gotten loans in the first place. Lots of speculative buying. And when the house of cards tipped over, it just completely crashed. We're not looking at that this time. There are millions of homeowners across the country sitting on 3% mortgages right now for properties that they recently bought or recently refinanced. And if they don't have to sell, they're not going to sell into a market where they're going to have to sell that house and get something with a 6% mortgage. They're not going to sell into a market where home prices are declining if they don't have to. And that was a big difference in the last session. If you think about where we are today, we have a record amount of homeowner equity, about $27 trillion. Our data at Adam says that even people currently in foreclosure, 90% of them have positive equity. And you compare that with where we were in the Great Recession when there, you know, a third of all homeowners were underwater on their loans. So the dynamics are very different. A lot of people then did have to sell their house. We had 15 million borrowers on adjustable rate loans that many of them had teaser rates. Some were negative amortization loans. Real nightmare. And again, the lending has been much more rational this time. The loan performance is extraordinary. The Fed has done probably a better job than it expected in terms of slowing down the demand side of the housing market by pretty much any criteria you look at, Jim. The Mortgage Bankers Association tracks purchase loan applications. That index is running about 20% lower than 2019 and 2021. You have to kind of throw out 2020 as the pandemic year. If you look at pending home sales, they're off year over year about 12 months in a row now. And so the things you look at in order to kind of figure out what demand looks like are all slowing down. And home sales have been off. The Bloomberg chart is not an aberration. And it's not just new home sales. We've seen 6 consecutive months of lower existing home sales. We've seen probably a full year now of existing home sales that are lower than they were the prior year. And this is all about affordability. This is as the Fed battled inflation, raising Fed funds rate, that had an impact on the mortgage market. Those rates have almost doubled. And the combination of mortgage rates going up and home prices going up makes it 40% more expensive for somebody to buy a house today than it was a year ago for the same property. So that's had a very telling effect. The most recent numbers I saw were that nationally home sales were off by 15% year over year in June. And here in Southern California, they were off about 27% year over year. What's interesting, though, is prices have still held up. So there's enough demand for the properties that are coming to market. But as demand drops, you'll see inventory rise because the pace of sales is going down. So it's not just that more homes are coming to market, which is true, but it's taking longer for those properties to sell once they get there, which does have a tendency to move up those inventory numbers.
Rick, I have read, and you have a better feeling for this number, that we are short somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 5 million homes. And as you mentioned earlier in this conversation about this new household formation that's coming in with millennials that will be starting families looking to buy a home, and there just isn't enough homes out there for them to buy.
Yeah, that's the builders basically went on vacation for about a decade. And I hope they enjoyed themselves. So they had been ramping up building activities until the Fed started to raise rates and sales trailed off. And the builders got the memo this time. One of the problems we had last time was they overbuilt. So you're talking about inventory a minute ago. In a normal market, a market with equilibrium, there's about a 6-month supply of homes available for sale. At the low point over the last couple of years, we were at about a month and a half supply nationally. Even with the raising levels of inventory, we're at about a 2.5 month supply. So a little more than a third of what we would normally expect. As we entered the Great Recession, we had a 13-month supply of homes because the builders just never stopped building. So, you know, again, a different dynamic. We had twice as many homes as we could eat last time. We have about a third as many as we need this time. And that's really what keeps those prices up. And in terms of those demographics we talked about, it's probably through 2024, 2025, where we continue to see those kind of tailwinds pushing the housing market forward before things settle down a little bit. The other thing that's been a little confusing to analysts is that baby boomers have stubbornly decided to age in place rather than sell their homes and downsize. So we're seeing, you know, the second biggest generation in history not making homes available for sale in a time period that most people had predicted they would. So, you know, there's a number of reasons for low inventory, but right now the builders, I hope, will continue to build more than they have been, but in a measured sense so they don't overshoot the mark.
Yeah, it's amazing that you mentioned something about boomers. Some of my boomer retired clients are choosing not to move, and some of them are staying here in California, though we have quite a few retiring and going to other states. But those that are staying in place are doing things, maybe this was the pandemic, or, you know, they're fixing up their house, they're putting in special kind of bathtubs and bathrooms that you do as you get older, easier to get in and out of, and making their house more suitable for aging.
Yeah, that was a trend that actually started before the pandemic. It may have accelerated a little bit during the pandemic. But if you follow the do-it-yourself store stocks, the Home Depots, the Lowe's of the world, you see they did a ton of business over the last few years. And a lot of that was boomers renovating their homes to make them more livable so they could age in place there. And then, you know, the mess we had with retirement homes during the pandemic, especially in states like New York, which just did about everything possible wrong in terms of handling the pandemic as it came to retirement homes, I think probably encouraged more boomers to stay exactly where they were, just out of a concern for safety. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a while before we see a lot of those homes come forward. One of the things we might see, by the way, because of that, is an increase in reverse mortgages as boomers tap into some of the equity that they've accumulated over the years while they've lived in those homes.
That's amazing you say that. I have a 1 o'clock appointment with a client that's considering just that, tremendous appreciation in his home, and he's wanting to tap into it. He's a widower, and so he's just by himself with all this equity in his home and would like to have more income. So this is probably a trend we're going to see more of. Rick, let me ask you this. Given what the Fed is doing now, they're raising interest rates. Like I said, we're doing this on a Tuesday. It's expected on Wednesday they go 75 basis points. What would you tell? Let's take two situations. One, first-time home buyer. Let's take a millennial couple. What would you do now? And number two, a couple, let's say they live in California or New York, and they're seeing the crime, the high cost of living, and they want to move. But where do you move where prices are still cheap and the weather is halfway decent?
Yeah, the weather's the issue there, isn't it?
Yeah.
South Dakota is beautiful in the spring and summer. I'm not sure I really want to be there in January. So let's take the first-time buyers first. Normally, I go back to the old real estate cliche that the best time to buy a house was 15 years ago, and the second best time is today. In today's market, I'd actually say take a step back and do two things. One, make sure you're absolutely ready financially to make the commitment it's going to require to afford the house you want. And second, I'm of the opinion that mortgage rates are probably at or very near their peak and are likely to trickle down just a little bit in the coming year. Home prices are also still going up a little bit more rapidly than I like. But most people, including us, are projecting that home price appreciation will slow down pretty dramatically as we get to the end of this year and into next year. So if you're gainfully employed, your wages are going up, it might not be the worst idea in the world to wait just a little bit and see if the market doesn't settle down and become a little bit more of a balanced market, or in some cases, even a little bit of a buyer's market. If you're the couple looking to get out of the high cost, high tax states, you probably don't have the same reason to wait. And you know, the Midwest, the Southeast are probably the most popular destination areas right now. You're not going to get California weather pretty much anywhere other than California, maybe Hawaii. I do know some people moving to Phoenix and Nevada, but those are very, very hot places to live. So I'm hearing a lot of things about places like Tennessee, South Carolina, North Carolina, where you have moderate temperatures, where even though prices have gone up, they're still very affordable compared to California and New York prices. There's a ton of population moving from New York to Florida. Used to be winter snowbird types, but now they're moving there permanently. So I think if you're looking for that combination of price and weather, you're probably looking at the southeastern states.
Yeah, I have a couple that is moving to Tennessee. Their kids have already left the state because they couldn't afford to buy a home. They moved to Tennessee, they pay no taxes, and they actually own a home. So, yeah. You know, this couple is going to follow their kids. Well, Rick, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow all the – you guys put out a ton of data on the real estate market, rental market, investment in real estate. How could they follow you?
Yeah, we do. We publish reports pretty much every week, and you can find those on our website, which is atomdata.com. That's ATTOM data.com, and look for the insights area. We also post on LinkedIn and Twitter, and you can follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter as well. It's just Rick Sharga, Sharga. And happy to compare notes with people on social media.
All right. Well, Rick, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. So the takeaway here, if you're leaving an expensive state like California, New York, well, there's a lot more places on the East Coast, maybe Midwest, that are cheaper. And if you're a new couple starting a home, well, maybe just sit back a little bit and let prices soften. Rick, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Thanks for having me, Jim. Hope to do it again soon.
Chris Poplava is the CIO of Financial Sense Wealth Management, and he joins us today for another edition of Smart Macro. So, Chris, as you know, this week was a really big week with lots of different data and events that took place. The Fed met with a second 75 basis point hike. That's 0.75%. They also hinted that rates are close to neutral, and the market rallied on that news, thinking that this was a dovish pivot, as some are referring to it as. With a very strong market reaction yesterday. And on the day that we are speaking, which is Thursday, the day after, we got a negative 0.9% print for the second quarter on U.S. GDP. So we now have two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. And many people use that as a rule of thumb for a recession, but though technically, as we've been discussing internally, that is not the actual definition or criteria that the official recession dating community NIRBR uses, as they've declared on their website for many years. So let's begin there. What are your thoughts on this week's major events?
Well, you know, I think obviously the Fed and the second reading on economic growth of the U.S. are the big moving events. But preceding the Fed meeting, one of the things I wanted to touch upon in our weekly investment meeting was looking at the idea of a possible peak in inflation. Obviously, that is really what the average consumer is fixated on, as well as the Fed. And what we showed is that when you look at market-based expectations of inflation, those are coming down. So when you look at, for example, 10-year break-even inflation rates, 5-year, 2-year, 1-year, these have all declined significantly from their peaks earlier this spring. And historically, I showed that the 2-year break-even leads, in general, the overall inflation rate. Now, there are times where it's coincident, but you know, if it ever diverges with the current CPI rate, usually it leads, it doesn't lag. So, you know, there are a lot of signs that point towards a peak in inflation. Secondly, if you look at commodity prices, those tend to lead headline inflation, and all of these metrics are pointing to a peak in inflation basically happening right about now. Secondly, one of the things that Powell has talked about is to that the Fed wants to achieve is that inflation expectations do not become unanchored. And because the reason for that is you can kind of get a self-fulfilling cycle where if everyone feels like inflation will be persistently high, they tend to spend early to avoid price hikes, which then even, you know, creates more demand on the economy and pushes inflation even higher. So it's kind of like a self-reinforcing process. And when we look at inflation expectations, again, you know, there's a couple of ways to look at it. As I mentioned, 10-year break-even rates, they're nowhere close to the current annual 9% inflation rate in the U.S. They're much lower than that. When you look at consumer long-term expectations for inflation, so we can look at University of Michigan's inflation expectations for the consumer, those diverge sharply from the current inflation rate, meaning that current inflation trends are not pushing into consumers' expectations for the long-term outlook on inflation. So as of right now, I would say inflation expectations are not coming unglued. They remain firmly anchored, which is a good sign for the Fed. Secondarily, the other aspect is a lot of indications point towards a peak in the inflation rate. Now, a lot of the indicators that we track, they basically tell you or hint at trend, but not the level. So while we may see a peak in inflation, what we don't know is how dramatic the decline will be. And more than that, what kind of decline is the Fed looking for? So in prior press conferences, Jerome Powell has mentioned he wants to see several consecutive months of falling inflation. But, you know, kind of like a good forecast, you don't give your price target in time. You only give one, not both. You know, Powell didn't say, you know, how much of a change in the inflation rate he wants to see. Just said he wants to see a consecutive decreases in inflation. So we really don't know how big of a decline is enough for the Fed to see. And then, you know, as you alluded to, Chris, you know, market participants really jumped yesterday when we saw the Fed mention that it feels like it is close to the neutral rate. And the neutral rate being is the rate of monetary policy that does not stimulate or contract the economy. So basically, it's the rate where the economy should be at stall speed. Now, the markets took off inferring that the Fed is likely close to being done. Now, you know, the thing I want to point out is, how do you bring down inflation? You know, what is the Fed trying to do? The Fed is trying to tighten financial conditions to bring down demand. So essentially, the Fed is trying to contract or decelerate the economy to bring down overall demand, which then would help to bring down overall inflation trends. Well, how do you do that? You have to go beyond the neutral rate, obviously. You know, the rate at which Fed policy begins to contract the economy. And Powell has mentioned that, you know, he basically is willing to allow the U.S. to go into recession to return to price stability, basically hinting that price stability is more important for long-term employment trends. So you can't have persistently full employment if inflationary trends and price instability are your backdrop. So, you know, it really kind of points to what the Fed is looking to achieve is some price stability and I think a pretty significant decline in current inflation rates.
So, Chris, just to reiterate what you said earlier, this is a pretty, I don't want to say a big call, but I think a notable call and something that we should underscore here is that you're saying very likely we have now seen the peak in the headline CPI inflation number at 9.1% year over year for, which was last month for June, that's most likely when we look at the market-based measures and we look at the preponderance of the data out there at this point, that's most likely the peak.
That's what I'm leaning towards. I mean, you know, month to month is noise. You know, a single data point doesn't make a trend. So, you know, let's say even if we decline for the July reading, which is quite likely given the decline in energy prices, it very well could head back up. But I do think in hindsight, we'll see that, you know, basically the middle of 22 was the peak in inflation. But, you know, as we talked earlier, Chris, you know, we discussed the neutral rate. There's a couple of other really important rates to, you know, bear in mind in terms of how they can impact interest rates, growth, and inflation. There's the output gap, which basically measures what or estimates what the long-term growth rate is for the U.S. economy. And if the U.S. has basically operating above that level, meaning it's growing above potential, that probably puts pressure upward on inflation and interest rates. And if the economy is growing below potential, that tends to bring down interest rates and inflation. So currently, you know, everyone's fixated on the neutral rate of inflation, or I'm sorry, of monetary policy. You know, we still have a positive output gap, meaning The U.S. is growing above potential when you look at where things stand compared to our long-term growth rate. And then secondarily, you know, another really important part to look at is, you know, the Fed has a dual mandate, price stability and full employment. Well, you know, the idea on full employment is an estimate, kind of like the neutral rate, where basically there are estimates out there that the Congressional Budget Office puts out to estimate what is the long-term rate of unemployment, meaning, you know, you're always going to have some kind of unemployment in a society. And what would be the estimate for a normal or natural rate of unemployment? And currently, that estimate is at 4.3%. Right now, the U.S. has a 3.6% unemployment rate. So what that implies is when we have a lower unemployment rate than the natural rate of unemployment, that means that labor is tight, which we've been hearing from businesses all over, which then leads to wage inflation. So wage inflation continues to be sticky. I think will be likely a reason why we're not going to get down to 2% inflation anytime soon. I do think we're going to moderate, but I just do not see 2% anytime soon. So, you know, how do you basically get wage inflation to move in the opposite direction? Well, you need the unemployment rate to be above the natural rate of unemployment. How do you get that? You get that through a recession. So, you know, that's really the risk, is for the Fed to get down to its long-term goal of 2% inflation. I really think that, you know, to get there, the Fed's going to have to induce a recession. So that's why I think the market yesterday cheering that the Fed may be close to the neutral rate of monetary policy is really missing some broader contextual issues that the market must digest in the months ahead.
Right, right. And, you know, we were discussing that on FS Insider this week with Nick Reese about how, you know, when we look at the peak hawkishness of the Fed, that's kind of what the futures market is predicting, with a peak in inflation, as you said. What is it that you're looking at? You were sharing some data and research with us internally, seeing where the Fed is likely to move. And this is pretty accurate historically. Would you mind sharing that with our audience?
So, you know, essentially, one of the things we looked at was, and, you know, this really kind of stemmed from comments by the bond king, Jeff Gundlach at Double Line. Essentially, he said that we should replace the Federal Reserve with the two-year Treasury yield. Get rid of, you know, all of the PhD economists that we basically finance or pay for at the Federal Reserve. Get rid of all of the meetings, all of the, you know, uncertainty regarding Fed policy, and just replace the Fed funds rate with the two-year Treasury yield. The reason why I said that was the two-year Treasury yield consistently rises prior to the Fed starting a rate cycle, and it declines prior to our rate cut cycle. And so when I looked at the two-year Treasury, I was basically trying to identify, you know, some key inflection points that hint at either a pause and or rate cuts in the future. And what I found was that when the two-year Treasury yield hits a two-month new low, that generally starts the clock for when the Fed will have its last rate hike. And historically, that's around 2 months. So let's just assume that in August, the two-year Treasury hits a two-month low in terms of its yield. That would target basically somewhere around September, October for the Fed to have its last rate hike. Now, in terms of rate cuts, there what I was looking at was how far the two-year Treasury has fallen below the Fed funds rate before we get some kind of a response out of the Fed. And there what I found is when the two-year Treasury yield is at least a half a percent or more below the Fed funds rate, you typically see the Fed start to cut interest rates on average within 2 months. So essentially, the two-year yield falling to a two-month low gives you a two-month lead time before the Fed pauses. When it falls more than half a percent below the Fed funds rate, that also is a roughly two-month lead time until the Fed cuts rates. So, you know, this is why I, you know, emailed everyone internally that I'm keeping a close eye on 2.5%. Because if the two-year gets to that level or lower, that will represent not only a two-month low, but if the Fed does what the market expects and raises rates 50 basis points in September, that would also represent a half a point below the Fed funds rate and suggest that by the end of the year, the Fed actually may be cutting rates. So again, you know, this analysis was done when inflation was obviously much lower. I do think the hurdle rate for the Fed to pause and cut rates is much higher. And so, you know, this is why this will be something we're watching very closely ahead. And it's just a tool. But it does argue that the market, you know, the more long-term rates fall, the more the yield curve gets inverted, it's basically a market believing the Fed that it will allow a recession to occur to achieve its goal of price stability. So essentially, the Fed is willing to sacrifice the economy on its monetary altar to basically achieve its goals.
So again, lots of sign that we've seen a peak in inflation at 9.1%. That is going to take some pressure off the Fed moving forward over the next several meetings. However, tell us, what are your thoughts? Are we in a recession or not?
Yeah, I was listening to an interview by Jim Bianco, and he made a good point. I looked at the data and confirmed it, that when you go back to the post-World War II era, so let's just say 1950 onward, whenever you have seen two consecutive quarters of negative real GDP growth, that has only occurred in a Nerber officially defined recession. So yes, two quarters back to back, a negative real GDP is just the technical definition, not the official. It's important to know that you've never seen that outside of a recession. So in my opinion, Chris, I think basically we are either in a recession right now or we are going to be in one in a matter of months. I think it's a done deal. I think it's only a matter of time. And that really will have important implications for the market. Because when you study past cycles of Fed policy, when they pause, typically you get a market rally in bonds, meaning yields go down, bond prices go up, and typically you get a market rally in the stock market. Now, the key differentiating factor is what happens a few months beyond the initial pause or the last rate hike. If the U.S. economy slips in a recession, you have a further hit to the economy, you have a hit to corporate earnings, job losses, the market rally by the stock market eventually rolls over, it's short-lived, and you go into a bear market and usually lower prices beyond the pause by the Fed. So again, the market cheered the idea that maybe the Fed is getting closer to a pause. However, you cannot lose sight of the economy. If the U.S. is slipping into recession, corporate earnings are going to fall. Price estimates need to come down for individual stocks, the index as a whole. And I still think that estimates for earnings for the stock market are too high, and they're likely to come down further. But another point I want to make, Chris, is that even let's say the Fed raises rates in September by 50 bips, they get to 3%, and let's say that's the pause, or maybe they raise another 25 basis points in November and then declares victory. That's not a pause because the Fed is also shrinking its balance sheet. This is something we've had to contend with in the last two cycles. Basically, the Fed in 2018 was continuing to raise rates and it was still shrinking its balance sheet. So while the last rate hike was December 19th of 2018, the Fed continued to shrink its balance sheet into the first quarter of 2019. So the Fed wasn't officially pausing its tightening cycle. It just was dropping one avenue or aspect of it. And what the Fed reiterated yesterday was that they are on track to double the amount of balance sheet reduction that they're undergoing to get to $95 billion a month. It essentially is quantitative easing in backwards, almost of the same magnitude that the Fed was printing money and expanding its balance sheet. The Fed will be contracting its balance sheet. Now, this has a huge implication for valuations for the market in terms of price multiples, where essentially the market price multiple is very sensitive to trends in liquidity. And one of the things I shared internally is just looking at M2 money supply, looking at its annual change relative to the PE ratio or price to earnings ratio of the S&P. So as liquidity is abundant, people are more willing to pay more for a dollar of earnings, driving market valuations higher. And the opposite is true. When liquidity begins to recede, people are less willing to pay for a dollar of earnings. And so you typically see price multiples collapse. And the Fed has had no hint at all that they're even close to a neutral rate of balance sheet reduction. The Fed is going to continue reducing its balance sheet. There's no pause there. In fact, just the opposite. The Fed is talking about accelerating how much it's shrinking its balance sheet in the months ahead. So again, even if the Fed pauses rate hikes, we're nowhere close to the Fed stopping shrinking its balance sheet. So that's why I feel like a pause is not really a pause when the Fed is still pulling on the other lever, essentially to slow liquidity and financial markets.
Well, Chris, with that said, where do you think things are headed and what's your outlook moving forward?
Well, as we mentioned earlier in this interview, I do think the inflation rate is in the process of peaking. So, you know, the uncertainty is, you know, how much it declines from here. One thing I have a pretty high conviction on is that the economy will continue to decelerate. The reason why is that monetary policy and fiscal policy hit the economy with a lag, meaning the action the Fed took yesterday, that 75 basis point hike, will still be hitting the economy a year from now, at least. So when you look at the financial market in terms of interest rates in general, whether it's mortgage rates, treasury rates, or even the Fed funds rate, the huge jump and spike that we've seen are yet to basically have their full impact on the economy. And when you think about that, that's concerning given, you know, we are already in the textbook definition of a recession. And the economic data, particularly housing, is likely to continue to erode for the remainder of this year going into next year. So in that context, in my opinion, any rally that we have is likely to be proved a bear market rally, meaning that I still see lower prices for stocks ahead. Now, that said, I do think that we have seen the peak in bond yields. So I still feel firmly that the market will basically continue to digest slowing economic data as a concern for a eventual and or deeper recession on the horizon, which would then drive interest rates lower. So I think bonds or long-term treasuries are in a good position. That is completely opposite to how our firm felt going into this year. Going into this year, we had our average maturity for our bonds for our clients at the lowest possible level, as well as the overall allocation to bonds at the lowest possible level. So, you know, this is a marked departure from essentially what we were telling our investors and clients going into this year. We have completely reversed course and do believe that long-term rates have peaked and will likely head lower as we continue to see a deceleration in the U.S. economy. So still remain bearish on stocks. There is some value out there, which always happens during market declines, but I still think there's some pain ahead. And, you know, one of the things I was reiterating, which I, you know, basically was saying to clients in early 2009, you know, it was kind of the words from the movie Braveheart, where William Wallace is saying, hold when you have the cavalry charging ahead of you. So, you know, I still think that's an important thing for investors to do, is to hold, to avoid the fear of missing out on a market rally. I believe it will just be temporary. And I think the best thing to do is to hold and stay on the sidelines with the defensive posture until things become more clear.
Chris, on that note, would you mind telling our listeners about some of the services that we provide here at Financial Sense Wealth Management?
Sure. We provide a whole host of financial services. We provide financial planning, wealth management. We also do 401k servicing, consulting, and we also assist corporations in managing their cash balance.
If any of our listeners would like to get in touch with our financial advisors, what would be the best way to do so?
They can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you again on Smart Macro. We look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks.
If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.